Welcome to the Medici Podcast, episode 59, Eve of an Atrocity. If you enjoyed the podcast, support me on Patreon, recommend the show to a history lover in your life, or rate the show on the podcast platform of your choice. Also, be sure to go to MediciPodcast.com if you want to see images, bibliographies, maps, and more. And with that, the Edict of Saint Germain had brought about an uneasy peace. Catherine worked to solidify it through marriage alliances. Her own daughter, Elizabeth, Queen of Spain, had died from complications caused by a miscarriage, not long after she had her unsatisfactory meeting with Catherine de' Medici on the French border. Despite their bad last meeting, Elizabeth had been her confidant and one of the children she was closest to. Even with her grief, though, Catherine could not afford to keep King Philip of Spain out of the family and risk him invading France himself to deal with the Huguenot menace. So she soon offered him the hand of her youngest daughter, Marguerite, or Margot. Philip turned down the proposal. Instead, he married his niece-slash-cousin, Anna of Austria. The Habsburgs have their reputation for inbreeding for a reason. Anyway, Catherine did manage to wed her son, King Charles IX, to Anna of Austria's sister, confusingly also named Elizabeth. But Catherine also looked outside the Habsburgs, since her strategy was to set up a wide range of alliances in case Philip of Spain did turn on her. To that end, she had an ambitious match in mind for her favorite son, Edward, who took the name Henri at his confirmation. His bride would be no one less than Queen Elizabeth of England herself. I'm going to call Henri by his title, the Duke of Anjou, for the sake of convenience. At the time, Anjou was 19 and Elizabeth was 37, but age was much less of an obstacle than religion. With the hardline Catholic Guise family whispering in his ear, Anjou refused to even consider marrying a heretic, queen or no. No doubt Elizabeth wasn't thrilled about it either, but at the time no one knew she would be remembered as the Virgin Queen. Instead, Anjou hoped to wed his former sister-in-law, Mary Queen of Scots. Unfortunately, by then she was no longer reigning over Scotland, and instead had been overthrown and wound up a prisoner enjoying Queen Elizabeth's quote-unquote hospitality in England. Catherine could not deny Anjou, her favorite son, anything, so she didn't press the issue. And anyway, Queen Elizabeth still agreed to a mutual defense pact between the two countries that was meant to contain any threat from Spain. And Elizabeth also held out the hope that she might instead choose to marry Catherine's youngest son, Ercole, who had also changed his name upon his confirmation to Francois. Meanwhile, even though they were no longer at open war, the Catholic and Protestant factions in France rallied behind a new generation of leaders. On the Huguenot side was someone we've met before, Admiral Gaspard de Coligny, Montmorency's nephew. Despite being a known devout Huguenot, he had become something of a father figure to King Charles IX, who called Coligny his good friend and even father. Coligny had been banished from court over his involvement in the Civil War, but by 1571, Charles IX had not only invited him back to Paris, but had granted him a lifelong pension. The new leader of the Catholic League was the new Duke of Guise, frustratingly also named Henri, and so I'll refer to him by his title. He was handsome, blue-eyed, and muscular, a Hemsworth of the 16th century. On top of the probably fictitious claim to be directly descended in the male line from Charlemagne, his mother, Anne d'Este, was the daughter of King Louis XII's own daughter, Renee, which meant Guise might have been the rightful king of France if not for that pesky Salic law thing. He firmly believed Coligny was behind the assassination of his father, which made the conflict not just about religion, but personal vengeance. So it galled him that Coligny was hovering over the king almost as much as the king's mother did. Given what's coming, Charles IX's proximity to Protestants might be surprising. Not only did he have Coligny as a surrogate dad, but his mistress Marie Touchet was a Huguenot. Catherine actually seems to have tolerated this relationship, so much so she had a hunting lodge set aside for Charles and Marie's rendezvous. She saw Charles's relationship with Coligny as the real threat. Once, when the admiral was away from court, Catherine confronted her son in terms that do sound timeless to anyone who's experienced a maternal guilt trip. After all the pains that I had to bring you up and to preserve your crown, after having sacrificed myself for you and run a thousand dangers, how could I ever have dreamed that you would reward me so miserably? You hide yourself from me, your mother, in order to take counsel from your enemies. You wrench yourself from my arms, which have guarded you, to lean on the arms of those who once desired to kill you. Catherine may have particularly feared that Coligny was steering King Charles toward a catastrophic war, although some modern historians like Mac Holt have suggested that Coligny did not have as much of an influence over Charles as testimonies from the time imply. And already, Catherine and Charles were following a policy of fake neutrality, while they did nothing to stop their Huguenot subjects from giving support to the rebels across the border. As the historian Arlette Juana puts it, Charles IX still went on publicly denying the encouragements he gave to the Dutch rebels, and Philip II diligently pretended to believe him. It seems likely that Coligny did want Charles to go a few steps further and directly intervene in the Netherlands in support of the Dutch rebels, which would have almost certainly caused a war with Spain. Catherine vehemently opposed such an escalation, since she knew this not just risked a Spanish war, but would have also strained France's new alliance with England. Queen Elizabeth might have seen the Dutch rebels as her co-religionists, but English trade depended heavily on the Netherlands. So she didn't want France to gain an opportunity to annex or set up a puppet monarchy in the Netherlands, any more than she wanted to see Spain keep its grip on the region. On the streets outside the world of the royal court and high politics, anger over the recent conflicts between Huguenots and Protestants stayed fresh. In Paris, there was a pyramid topped by a large cross. It marked the site of the home of a wealthy Huguenot merchant, Philippe de Gastein, who was executed along with his son Richard for hosting an illegal religious gathering. After they were killed, a mob looted and burned down their house and erected the pyramid and cross in the ruins as a lasting monument to their victory. The Huguenots of Paris assumed that the monument would be taken down, since the Edict of Saint-Germain also called for the erasure of any such tangible memories of the Civil War. Yet, the monument remained. The Huguenots appealed to Charles IX, who ordered that the pyramid be destroyed and the cross taken to a cemetery. However, the Parliament of Paris refused to register Charles's edict, a sign of just how much the authority of the king had decayed, despite Catherine's best efforts. Even when Charles made Parliament submit, the provost of Paris dragged his feet, claiming he lacked the funds to pay for the necessary labor. Even after Charles pressed the issue further, guards sent to protect the site were pelted with stones. While eventually the cross was finally removed, the homes of Philippe de Gastein's surviving family were also attacked and burned down by a mob. In the face of such violence, Catherine needed to have something to help guarantee that the Catholic and Huguenot leaders wouldn't throw a match into the gasoline ever again. To that end, she decided on the same approach she took to foreign policy: marriage alliances. In this instance, she would arrange a double marriage. One would be between the new Prince of Condé, who of course was also named Henri, to Mary of Cleves. Mary was a Protestant too, but she was also the sister of Catherine, a Catholic who was married to the Duke of Guise. The more important and controversial of the two marriages, though, was that of Catherine's daughter Margot to Henri de Bourbon, the Protestant prince of the blood who stood on the line of succession after Catherine's children. Catherine had high hopes for this particular match. As she wrote, "Nothing can make us hope for the full increase of our religion and the universal peace of this kingdom than the marriage of my daughter and the Prince of Navarre." Let's take a moment to meet the happy couple, neither of whom were particularly enthusiastic about the match, even by the standards of arranged political marriages. Marguerite or Margot was Catherine's youngest and only still unmarried daughter. She was tall, attractive, witty, and quite intelligent. The writer Brantôme, who was Margot's personal friend, praised her as "versed in learning, both sacred and profane, and delighted by books. She would always be taken for a goddess from the skies, rather than for an earthly princess." She had a sincere interest in scholarship, and apparently alone out of all of Catherine de' Medici's children, she was the only one who was able to become fluent in Latin. Margot's future mother-in-law, Queen Jean, complained about Margot's habit of wearing makeup and drawing in her waist. She also wore a blonde wig over her naturally brunette hair and was something of a fashion icon in her own day. Margot was rumored to have been lovers with the Duke of Guise, something she vehemently denied in her memoirs when she described how her brother Anjou accused her of such an affair in front of their mother. Perhaps the two were lovers at some point, although not around 1570 when this episode takes place, since the records suggest they were nowhere close to each other for over a year. As for Henri de Bourbon, he was quite the mismatch with his bride. He was unattractive by the standards of his time and ours, especially because of his disproportionately large nose. He was so short, he needed a platform to get on his horse, and he wore clothes without any lace or embroidery. Also, Henri's body odor was the stuff of legends. Later in life, his son, King Louis XIII of France, would joke, "My father is near. I smell his armpit." Nor did Henri quite receive the urbane, cosmopolitan education of Marguerite de Valois, Henri's grandfather, then the King of Navarre, who was unfortunately also named Henri, ordered that Henri be raised like a peasant of the Pyrenees region, allowed to run barefoot outside and given a simple diet of beef, cheese, garlic, and onion soup. Henri's first language wasn't even French, which he learned in adolescence, but Gascon, which, depending on which linguist you ask, is either a unique Romance language spoken in what is now southwest France or a dialect of the Provençal language. Opposition to the marriage was fierce, not least because marriage to the sister of a reigning king would only strengthen Henri de Bourbon's own claim to the throne over the inconvenient fact that he was a heretic. Pope Pius V wrote to Catherine scathingly, "We are certain that Satan and the sons of the light have nothing in common." Pius and his successor as Pope, Gregory XIII, would both refuse to grant a papal dispensation to deal with the fact that Margot and Henri were both cousins in the third degree. Although she had agreed to the idea and participated fully in the negotiations, Queen Jean of Navarre also had her doubts. She apparently approached Margot in private to test out if she was willing to convert to Protestantism. Margot defiantly refused. Then Jean pleaded with her son to at least leave Paris after the marriage, saying, "I desire that you and your wife withdraw from this corruption." Yet Jean would not live to see if her son would follow her advice. She died from tuberculosis on April 4th, 1572, her illness apparently worsened by months of intense negotiation. This made Henri de Bourbon the King of Navarre. Catholics hoped that her death would derail the marriage, but they didn't realize that Catherine would literally defy the Pope himself for this marriage. As the wedding day approached, Catherine decided to deal with the fact that there was no dispensation by arranging that there would be no government couriers between France and Italy until after the marriage took place. This would stop word of any flat refusal by the Pope from reaching Paris before the important day. Catherine apparently knew the wisdom in the old saying, better to ask forgiveness than permission. After months of hard and heated bargaining, the conditions for the union of the princess and the heretic were laid out. The marriage ceremony would not be held in a church of either faith, the spouses would not hear a mass, and Henri's uncle, Cardinal Charles of Bourbon, would bless the marriage, but only in his capacity as a senior member of the family and not as a cardinal of the church. At last, despite all the obstacles and the fact that Henri de Bourbon caused a stir by arriving in Paris with a large retinue of prominent Huguenots, the marriage was held without incident on August 18th, 1572. The couple stood during the ceremony on a platform erected at the doors of Notre Dame, deliberately built high enough so a crowd could watch. While the men of the royal family dressed in yellow clothing embroidered with jewels, the Huguenots stood out, dressed in relatively simple clothes with no such embroidery. Catherine had defied the Pope himself for her fait accompli. But the specter of violence would appear again and help ensure that the last saying Catherine would be remembered for was being a peacemaker. Admiral Coligny and most of the Huguenot leaders stayed in Paris in order to meet with Catherine and Charles to present complaints about violations of the Edict of Saint-Germain. While returning from one meeting with the king, someone shot at Coligny from an upper story window. The bullet only hit Coligny in his arm, and he was quickly spirited away to his lodgings. The assassination attempt has traditionally been blamed on Catherine, but there's the problem that it made no sense for her to order such a hit. However much she opposed military intervention in the Netherlands, any attempt to kill Coligny would have only undone everything she staked on the marriage. A more likely suspect was the Guises, who still believed that Coligny had assassinated their family patriarch. By this point, King Charles's love for his surrogate father had already chilled. Coligny was apparently rather bad at self-censorship. In council meetings and when speaking with the king alone, Coligny got into the habit of warning Charles that he was endangering his throne or destroying his reputation by not sending a French army into the Netherlands or doing more to enforce the Edict of Saint-Germain. Coligny's emotional language bordered on outright threatening the king. Nor did it help that Coligny practically took over the Prince of Condé's position as the leader of the Huguenots. It's not surprising that Charles would complain in one letter, "He was more powerful and more obeyed by those of the new religion than I was." Quite simply, Coligny had long been overplaying his hand. It's after the assassination when historical knowledge breaks down and legend begins to enter the picture. We actually don't know exactly what happened after the attempted assassination. We don't even know if there was one meeting of the Royal Council or a series of meetings. What can be said is that the Royal Council had become convinced that there was an army of Huguenots outside Paris who were ready to march on the capital, slaughter the royal family and any Catholics they could get their hands on, and make Henri de Bourbon king. Someone, we don't know who, proposed that they should launch a preemptive strike on the Huguenots while their leaders were still in Paris, waiting for Coligny to recover enough to travel. The identity of the person who first made this suggestion is, and barring some miraculous discovery in the archives, will always remain a mystery. It probably wasn't the king or Catherine, but they certainly approved of the idea. As much as Catherine sincerely wanted peace, she clearly thought that Coligny represented a real danger to her family. And anyway, she may have reasoned, if you cut off the heads of the Protestant Hydra with one clean stroke, that might be the end of it. Right? Join us next time as we enter Saint Bartholomew's Day.